Hello again, podcasters, and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts, as you know, we examine different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. Now, in today's podcast, just like we have done in previous years, I will take a look at everyday life stories in Kilkenny during the year 1922. As you'll be aware, even in times of the greatest upheaval, everyday life somehow manages to go on. Births, deaths, marriages, and even divorces still took place. And our grandparents would have been following the latest scandals of the time, often nothing whatsoever to do with the civil war that was going on. Of course, the year 1922 could be divided into two halves. The first half, from January to June 1922, was a time of general optimism. The treaty had been signed, the family members who had been imprisoned during the War of Independence were released, the British Army left Kilkenny, and the RIC were being disbanded during that time also. Then, of course, the second half of the year, that's July to December, was really a full-scale civil war, with sadness and worry being brought to the doors of Kilkenny folk. As we heard previously, Kilkenny City had a taster of what civil war was like in early May, when a battle between the two sides ensued following the split in the IRA. In many ways, actually, it may have been better for Kilkenny City's infrastructure to get that big battle out of the way before the civil war started proper, as by July shelling was used in the likes of Waterford City, etc., which also led to a higher risk of civilians being killed. So maybe, weirdly, for the city at least, the fact that it got its battle out of the way early could have actually been a positive thing looking back on it. Now, the stories I've selected here range from the humorous to the absolute tragic. Many have absolutely nothing to do with the ongoing civil war. Now, although Ireland was experiencing sweeping changes in regards to its civic and political governance in 1922, some more deeply ingrained moral attitudes showed no signs of altering. Although not a uniquely Irish thing, the country remained a very hostile place for unmarried mothers and their children. Single pregnant women often found themselves ostracised by their families and communities. They often had no alternative into Kilkenny but to seek shelter in the local union workhouse, or county home as they became known at this time. These were multifunctional healthcare providers that were financed through the local rate, so they had a hospital attached as well. For this reason, Kilkenny County Council had oversight and management, and more importantly, should I say, the cost of running these hospitals. In May 1922, after an unmarried woman from the Freshford district gave birth to a illegitimate child, inverted commas as they were called then, in the county home, it was decided by the county council to establish a committee to inquire into this and other cases that may arise. Local councillor and Farmers Party representative Dennis Gorey said that the council should lose no time in deciding on the most effective means to put down this evil. Gorey was far from the only person in Kilkenny to hold these views at the time. There existed a view, held by many, that the ratepayers' money should not be used to pay for fallen women, and that's another quote from the time, who had become pregnant. It was agreed by all in attendance at that council meeting, including the Mayor de Lucri, to establish a committee to deal with the issue of illegitimate children in the county. Now, in fairness, some would have been angry with the idle men who got these women into the family way, but it mostly came down to the pounds, shillings and pence of running the council and in turn running the hospital. Single mothers in workhouses or workhouse hospitals were costing ratepayers money. The views of these Kilkenny councillors were quite common, and it was the reason that the new Free State authorities encouraged the founding of mother and baby homes from 1922. They would take up the issue and they were seen as the solution to the problem. The nearest one to Kilkenny was in Tipperary. Poorer women, that being women from a working class background, still sometimes went to the workhouse or were sent to a Magdalen laundry. Even in the world of illegitimate childbirths, there was a class or hierarchy. Those whose families could afford it sent them to mother and baby homes, which were seen as a step up, believe it or not. It's hard to imagine that now. Now, in Thomastown in June 1922, there was another example of what could happen in a situation like this. An unmarried young servant girl, as she was called, Bridget, residing at the home of her employer, Joseph O'Keefe, in the townland of Columbkill, was charged with the alleged concealment of a birth. She was unaware she was pregnant and gave birth in her bedroom to a baby boy who passed away soon after being born, it was believed. Now, this might seem fanciful that someone didn't know they were pregnant, but there was very little education given to people about the birds and the bees, should we say, at this time. The day in question that she actually lost the baby, just a few weeks before the Civil War would break out, but it was also Patron Sunday in the parish. This was a big religious celebration in the parish for the feast day of St. Columbkill, the local saint. Most of these Patron Sunday celebrations have stopped in recent years. Bridget wrapped the remains of her little baby in a piece of cloth and put it in a soapbox. She buried the box in the old graveyard in Columbkill townland. Later that afternoon, at the Patron Day ceremonies in the graveyard, she told a friend, Lily Jordan, about what happened and where the box was buried. As we find out afterwards in the court records that still exist, this conversation was overheard by Margaret Murphy, whose family obviously presumably informed the authorities. Rumours began circulating around the parish as well, and 2 weeks afterwards, the body of the infant was discovered by a member of the Thomastown IRA who was investigating the rumours. The mother of the deceased baby was arrested on charges of the alleged concealment of a birth and the secret disposal of a body. Two doctors carried out a post-mortem at Thomastown Workhouse, but their findings were conflicting. Dr. O'Connor found that the baby was dead when born, but Dr. Mitchell believed the baby was born alive or partially alive. Now, if it was dead when born, she would have kind of got off on us a little bit, so maybe he was helping her out there, we're not really sure. Bridget was reprieved as the coroner was unable to determine whether the child had been born alive or not due to the absence of skilled attention at birth. Now, Bridget had been employed by the O'Keefes for about 5 years. Her employers, Mr. and Mrs. O'Keefe, paid her solicitor's fees and also provided £50 for a security bail bond. In a similar incident a few months later, in November 1922, in another part of Kilkenny, a baby's body, aged about 14 days, was found in a ditch near Gregna Manor. The mother was not traced. You couldn't blame her or any of these women in the circumstances they found themselves in. And of course, in neither of these two cases was the other party mentioned. That is to say, the fathers of these children. The blame appears to have fallen solely on the shoulders of the women. Now, some people often had a huge amount of sympathy for these women as they felt it could happen to them or their families. They just couldn't explicitly show that in public. And if a pregnancy was common knowledge in the parish anyway, it usually meant local men wouldn't be inclined to date or marry the women in question. Immigration was then often their only solution. As I have discovered actually when researching this period, pregnancy before marriage was actually quite common. Something I was led to believe wasn't the case. It's just that in many of those cases, the couple chose or perhaps were forced to marry. Now, once you were married, even a day before the baby was born, it was usually okay. Maybe except for a few sly digs, but once you had the ring on the finger before the baby was born, it was usually accepted in the parish. There was a different, but again sad story from Muckalee on the eve of the outbreak of the Civil War, that's the 26th of June 1922. Poor Thomas Tyrrell, a farmer from Coolpook, Muckalee, missed a very sad end. He had been suffering from what we would probably call today mental health issues, which had resulted in him causing some trouble in the district. The previous day, he had attacked some locals by throwing stones at them. As a result of this, his house was surrounded by the IRA police who were attempting to arrest him as he was deemed to be a lunatic, using the parlance of the time. Upon seeing the police, Tyrrell charged from the house with a stick in his hand and ignored calls to halt. A shot was fired by one of the policemen, hitting Tyrrell in the chest. He died shortly afterwards. One of the policemen was cautioned as a result of the incident. The inquest returned the verdict that Tyrrell died as a result of a bullet wound accidentally received and that there was no persons to blame for the occurrence. Now, of course, it just shows that firearms, often in the hands of undertrained young men, can lead to tragedy. There was another sad tale from Thomastown in September 1922. The newspaper report goes as follows, quote, "A child aged 2.5 years, whose parents, Mr. and Mrs. Edward Welch, a well-to-do farmers residing at Smithstown, Thomastown, was scalded to death on Wednesday by falling into a tub of boiling water. Although everything possible was done for the little sufferer, the child died within a few hours. Much sympathy is felt for the bereaved parents." End quote. Accidents in the house with fires and with boiling water were all too common in this era, as there was often lots of children and it was always exposed to that kind of danger. To change tact slightly, during the summer of 1922, although the country was in the grips of civil war by that stage, many in Kilkenny were more engrossed with a sensational divorce trial of a local couple than anything on the political scene. Civil divorce was available to everyone in Ireland prior to the Free State being founded. Of course, your religion was a separate thing and divorce in the church obviously wasn't allowed. Now, the petitioners were Evadne Bell and Isaac Bell. And Evadne, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, is spelled E-V-A-D-N-E. Evadne Bell was from Kilcreen House on the outskirts of Kilkenny City. She sought to divorce her husband of over 12 years, that being the aforementioned Isaac Bell. Now, he was then very well known locally as he was the master of the Kilkenny Foxhounds, i.e. master of the hunt in Kilkenny. He had been in the news a good bit in 1919 as the Kilkenny hunt was stopped by local Sinn Féin groups. Evadne, who was an All-Ireland winning croquet player, accused her husband of alleged misconduct with a person unknown. Her husband had originally asked for a divorce the previous August himself, as he wanted to marry someone else, but Evadne rejected the idea as she did not want to break up their house, which included their 8-year-old daughter, Diana Maud. In February 1922, a few months before this, a court had ordered the restitution of conjugal rights, which had not been complied with on Isaac's part. In other words, the court ordered Isaac to return to the marital bed. Eventually, Evadne petitioned for divorce herself, and at the subsequent trial, two employees of a London hotel gave evidence stating that Isaac had stayed in the hotel with a lady who was not his wife, end quote. In July 1922, the divorce was though eventually granted, with 42-year-old Isaac found guilty of alleged misconduct. Evadne, who was aged 37 at the time of her divorce, said they had lived a quiet life, but her husband was a difficult man to manage and she was never entirely happy. The couple had had two other children besides Diana, but they did not survive infancy. They had married in Kildare on the 10th of October 1909. Now, in September 1922, the Free State authorities issued a proclamation, which was during the first few months of the Civil War, of course. The proclamation went as follows, quote, "Notice is hereby given that all permits for motor vehicles in this area, compromising the city and county of Kilkenny, are cancelled as from September 7th, 1922. In future, permits to use such vehicles will only be issued by the national government. To those with a motor tax disc," end quote. So this is basically kind of a line in the sand moment for the authorities. Everyone basically needed a new license. It was to stop anti-treaty IRA moving around secretly with perhaps old permits or licenses. Now, just as relation to motor tax discs only came into being the year before. Another revenue source for the government, of course. They actually look very much like the discs now, they were just handwritten. Now, they knew the anti-treaty wouldn't have a disc as they didn't want to be giving money to the Free State, so another way of catching them out. By the way, driving motor cars during the Civil War was a risky business. Firstly, the roads were often blocked or trenched while bridges were regularly destroyed. In addition, from the anti-treaty point of view, the sound of an engine usually meant Free State soldiers were nearby. There is a hurling link to this story as well. The major hurling and Gaelic football matches, both at local and inter-county level, had to go on a hiatus during the summer on the autumn of 22. The friendly games that did take place did so with much difficulty. A motor car containing members of the Kilkenny County hurling team was pursued by a large number of Free State soldiers on lorries from Urlingford at one stage. The military had presumed the men were a party of anti-Treaty IRA. The hurlers were, though, eventually allowed to continue on their journey. Young men travelling by motor car rang alarms for the Free State soldiers. As you can imagine, driving long journeys outside the county also required an additional permit from the Free State authorities. Just like they had in 1920 and 1921, industrial disputes continued into 1922. Back in February 1922, Castlecomer Collieries, or coal mines, was making the headlines nationally and locally. In the early morning of Thursday the 9th of February, an estimated £10,000 worth of damage was done to the aerial ropeway between the Rockbog and Vera pits, with the corresponding engine and boiler destroyed. In addition, the engine house, which powered this coal transportation system, was also burnt down. The night staff had been detained by a number of armed and masked men during the attack. The elaborate aerial ropeway was actually quite advanced for the time. It covered a length of 11 miles, and this rope was cut in a number of places. There was much anger locally as the destruction of the coal mine's transport network resulted in the closure of one of the pits, leaving over 250 people out of work for a number of months. In response, the Kilkenny IRA Brigade Commandant George O'Dwyer, and this is before the IRA split came later on, placed parts of Castlecomer Parish under martial law and enforced a curfew between the hours of 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. This was to prevent vandalism of the coal mines, of course. The local IRA subsequently arrested 15 people they believed to be involved, however none were ever charged. All of those suspected of having caused the damage were carters. Now, I believe these were men who had previously carted the coal from the mines to the train line, which is over 4 miles away. After the aerial ropeway system was installed the previous year, all 25 carters employed at that mine lost their jobs. Hence, this was believed to be the most logical motivation for the act of sabotage. The colliery owners, the famed Wandesford family, later received compensation of £8,750, which was a few hundred thousand euro in today's money, which was levied against Kilkenny and Laois county councils at large. Of course, some of the former carters would have resided in Laois, hence them picking up some of the tab. The pit did, though, reopen in early April 1922, a few months later, to the relief of the employees. Now, although the county was in the throes of civil war, Kilkenny City Corporation continued to meet regularly and to carry out its usual business. In a special meeting of the corporation held in November 1922, the council approved one of its most ambitious plans yet, an electric lighting scheme for Kilkenny City. Interestingly, in terms of today's world, the electricity was to be generated using water power with a hydro station near Green's Bridge in the city. Hydroelectricity was actually becoming quite common in Ireland at this time, and lights used only a small amount of electricity, so it could be generated locally. In addition, there were always rows between the gas company and the corporation over the price it charged for gas, which was used, of course, for public lighting as well. So this seemed like a good solution. The council believed that the city was lagging behind similar sized towns in the country in terms of lighting, and so approved a project for the public lighting of the city by electricity. Prior to this, the majority of the city, it's hard to believe, would have been in darkness at night besides the light coming from businesses and houses, but it wouldn't have been very bright with lamps being the order of the day. Now, another little funny story I found in the Kilkenny Moderator newspaper also comes from February 1922. It goes like this, quote, "A profitable pig. A young sow, the property of Mr. Thomas Houlihan, Leggan, Thomastown, gave birth to 25 bonnives at a single farrowing. All are thankfully alive." End quote. That's an impressive sow there. Now, another thing I found interesting about this era that you don't see anymore in the local papers was the social sections. Along with the news on the royal family in England, the comings and goings of the Kilkenny upper classes or titled families were also reported. For example, here is a social scene report from the Kilkenny Moderator in March 1922 that was kind of sandwiched in between articles about the Treacy split and the Black and Tans leaving. Quote, "The Earl of Bessborough has returned to London from France," full stop. "The Marchioness of Ormond," that's of the Kilkenny Castle fame, "has returned to her London residence from Paris, where she attended the funeral of her sister, the late Mrs. Hickox. The Earl and Countess of Dysart were among the guests at the wedding breakfast of Princess Mary and Viscount Lascelles. County Carlow subscribed £40 towards a present for Princess Mary," end quote. And that Princess Mary story there is interesting, as Michael Collins was linked to her in the gossip columns when he was in London during the Treaty negotiations a few months previously. Princess Mary was the current Queen's aunt, and actually the only aunt she had in that side of the family, so she was quite famous in her day. Michael Collins' supposed connection to Princess Mary was thrown at him during the Treaty debates as an insult, of course, in that he was consorting with the enemy. She obviously had a quick rebound if that was the case. Of course, there is no evidence to suggest there was any connection between them whatsoever. The social section went on to give a Kilkenny connection to the newlyweds. Quote, "Lady Sybil Scott, younger daughter of the Earl and Countess of Dysart and cousin of Lord Lascelles, is lending the Villa Medici to Princess Mary and Viscount Lascelles for part of their honeymoon. Situated on a hill overlooking Florence, the house is the most beautiful of the villas of Florence," end quote. Now, during and after the Civil War, nearly 400 claims for compensation were lodged to the Free State Department of Finance regarding the loss or destruction of property in County Kilkenny during the civil strife. They make for some fascinating reading. The claims had a broad scope. For instance, the Oxo Company, who still exists today, of course, wanted reimbursement after a consignment of soup was stolen by the anti-Treacy IRA at Mullinavass railway station. In another unusual claim, Francis Bailey from Waterford City requested compensation after 5,000 artificial teeth were seized from a train at Dunkit Kilmacow. He was awarded £85. Teeth were obviously expensive back then as they are now. In another case, Arthur Curran from Warrenstown, Johnstown, requested reimbursement when his cow was shot by a Free State soldier. The animal had been grazing close to Erlingford Barracks when the soldiers were at rifle practice, with bullets whizzing through the air. One soldier's aim was evidently off, and the bullet went very much astray. Curran requested £50 compensation, but was eventually awarded £35 in compensation. Animals were worth a lot back then. Now, the Kilkenny people was worried about the health of women during this time, and it was not in relation of the ongoing war. They had taken this story from an English paper. The newspaper printed advice from doctors of England who decried the enormous increase of cigarette smoking amongst women. It went on to say that smoking amongst the female population, quote, is in many instances passing beyond the pleasure and becoming a vice. The absorption of nicotine produces a condition of nervous distress, and women's delicate nervous organism was certainly never intended to endure large doses of this poison, end quote. So it was an anti-smoking advertisement, but just on a different, completely different wavelength than is the case today. Now, I'll just finish off on a very light note, and it's a story coming from Christmas 1922, of course, at the end of the year, and it involves a runaway goose. Geese were the main thing people ate at Christmas back in the day. Turkeys were considered a bit of a luxury. So here's how the story goes. Quote, "No little amusement was caused in High Street and the vicinity of the parade on Wednesday morning last, when a goose broke loose from its captivity in an unknown abode. Hotly pursued by its custodians, the goose, which evidently did not wish to make the supreme sacrifice at Christmas, cleverly dodged its pursuers and was about to give up the ghost at the corner of the parade, but the sight of a civic guard apparently did not tend to bring matters to a head as far as the goose was concerned. Eyeing the guard with a sense of political disregard, the goose regained renewed energy, made off in the direction of the castle, but was run to the earth at the gravel walk by some six or seven stalwart fellows, and it is a foregone conclusion that the execution of the prisoner will duly be carried out according to the rules of the game, end quote. And I think that is where we leave it there today. Just to thank you all once again for listening, and don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time.